Blog Talk Radio.
My name is Alexa Servadidio. I am your host. For those who are new to the show this evening, I am a licensed clinical social worker and also a psychotherapist. I've been in this field for about 8 years now. I work at a large mental health clinic, and I also have my own private practice. I work with children, adolescents, adults. I do individual therapy, couples therapy, and family therapy. And a lot of the populations I work with range from anxiety, depression, domestic violence, sexual abuse and trauma, and some addiction. Well, tonight I brought back one of our other guest hosts, Maureen Johnson. Maureen, thank you for coming back with us.
Thank you very much. It's great to be back.
Great. Well, we have a great show set up for us tonight. I have a few questions from the community, a lot dealing with mental illness, addiction, and also conflict in the workplace. So let's get started with our first question. Dear Insight into Healing, how do I know if I'm addicted to something or just having too much fun? Well, I think when you come to this question, I think what a lot of it comes is, where did this question come from? I think, did someone tell you this, or was this something you came to by yourself? Because I think also what other people are noticing about you might be something to keep into consideration. But then also, is this something you've come to on your own? I actually looked up on Narcotics Anonymous World Services. They have, it's on the internet, they have a whole page saying, am I an addict? This is only you can answer these questions. This may not be something easy to do. All through our using, we told ourselves, I can handle it. Even if this was true in the beginning, it is not now. This is NA, so it's Narcotics Anonymous. So they say, the drugs handled us. We live to use and use to live. Very simply, an addict is a person whose life is controlled by drugs. They actually have a list of questions to go over and to ask yourself. And it said there's nothing shameful about being an addict once you begin to take positive action. If you can identify with our problems, you may be able to identify with our solution. The following questions were written by recovering addicts in Narcotics Anonymous. If you have any doubts about whether or not you're an addict, they said, take a few moments to read these questions below and answer them as honestly as you can. These are all yes and no questions. The first question is, do you ever use alone? Yes or no? I think this is also an important question, because I think, does it come to a part where you're by yourself drinking or using drugs, or do you find that you wake up on your own and you're using, or you stay home and, you know, make time just to use on your own? Or are you using out of loneliness, that you don't have any peer support or family support? One of the next questions is, have you ever substituted one drug for another, thinking that one particular drug was the problem? Yes or no? Have you ever manipulated or lied to a doctor to obtain prescription drugs? Now, this is a really big one right now, I found, with prescription drugs, especially when people have, you know, if they have an injury, they start taking prescription drugs because they're in pain and they need it and it's supposed to be temporary. And what they find out later is that they are so addictive that they end up actually becoming addicted to it. Have you seen any of this, Maureen?
Oh, definitely, yes.
And it's a really big problem, because I think what I've found with a lot of the clients that I work with is that they started because they've had, you know, an accident and they have severe back pain, and they need these drugs because they're in so much pain. But then they find their tolerance builds higher and higher, so they need more drugs, and then now they take them just to survive. And obviously they've started feeling in their gut that they've really become addicted to this. And your tolerance grows bigger and bigger. And I think this has been a big problem, because what do you do? Because if you stop the prescription drugs, you're still in pain. So I think this is like a really hard question to really to work on. I think also when you're on any type of drugs or even with alcohol, if you decide to stop them, always go to your doctor to be monitored, because they say alcohol and heroin are the top ones for withdrawal that you can actually really die from. It's very serious, especially with alcohol. When you go through detox and withdrawal, you definitely need to be in a facility to be watched. And I think also with prescription drugs, any type of, you know, if you're just going to stop cold turkey, I'd rather you go to a professional and say, listen, I'm going to stop. Either they wean you off or they watch you so you don't get, you know, really sick, because I've heard people, you get the sweats, vomiting, hallucinations, you can go into seizures. And I think it's something that you really shouldn't be doing alone, that you need support. And I know when it comes to addiction, there's a lot of shame and guilt, but I think it's so dangerous. I've had a few clients, you know, family members, friends, loved ones, who actually, you know, were ready to stop and quit cold turkey and end up dying from withdrawal. And I think it's really a serious, serious problem that I commend people who want to stop and want to do it on their own. But I think, again, making sure you have the right support system, as I always say on the show, safety first. Always, always safety first. The next question, have you ever stolen drugs or stolen to obtain drugs? Do you regularly use a drug when you wake up or when you go to bed? This can also go for alcohol. I know you're going to go next after I do with the narcotics with some stuff for alcohol, but this can also be for both. Do you avoid places or people that don't approve of your using? Have you ever used a drug without knowing what it was or what it would do to you? Has your job or school performance ever suffered from the effects of your drug use? Have you ever been arrested as a result of using drugs? Have you ever lied about what or how much you use? Do you put the purchase of drugs ahead of your financial responsibilities? Have you ever tried to stop or control your using? Have you ever been in jail, hospital, or drug rehab center because of your using? Does using interfere with your sleeping or eating? Now, that's really an interesting one, because I find when I've worked with people that are in addiction, that becomes their food, that becomes their sleep, and they really kind of give up on what they're eating. They lose their appetite, or even to get the drugs or the alcohol, they're not sleeping, which even causes so much more harm and damage to the mind, to the body, to just your functioning. As we said before in past shows, how important sleep is, and sleep disorders can really impact anxiety. What do you think?
Oh, definitely. Well, we spoke at length about the sleep disorders, and I think any kind of addiction interferes with sleep disorders.
Yes, it's really important. I think really if you really start noticing that your sleeping has been impacted, your eating, your regular daily routine, that's definitely something as to keep as a red flag and to keep an eye on. The next one, does the thought of running out of drugs terrify you? Do you feel it is impossible for you to live without drugs? Do you ever question your own sanity? Let's see, what's the next one? Is your drug use making life at home unhappy? That, again, came from the beginning when I was talking about, are others around you, your friends, your family, your husband, your wife, or your job, have they been saying something to you? And I know you said, how do you know if I'm addicted to something or having too much fun? I think that's a fine line. I think that line comes up when these questions start coming to your mind. I mean, once or twice, maybe someone says something to you, you can file it away and keep it as like a personal memo in your head. But if you find that a lot of people you really trust and care about are saying, hey, I'm concerned about you, I definitely think that's definitely a huge red flag to make sure you pay attention to. The next one, have you ever thought you couldn't fit in or have a good time without drugs? Have you ever felt defensive, guilty, or ashamed about your using? I think that happens, I find, with a lot of my clients, of them coming forward or even, you know, trying to get help is the shame and the guilt, and then they try to do it on their own. And what I've said before, it is so hard sometimes to do things on your own, and it doesn't mean that you're weak if you go to get help. So please, you know, make sure you definitely build up a team or a support system that, you know, Maureen and I have talked about in prior shows, that it's great to have definitely a team behind you. Next question. Have you ever felt defensive, guilty, or shamed? I think I just read that one. Sorry. You think a lot about drugs. Have you had irrational or indefinable fears? Has using affected your sexual relationship? Have you ever taken drugs you didn't prefer? Have you ever used drugs because of emotional pain or stress? I think that also comes to self-medicating. I think that's important, too. Sometimes people self-medicate due to depression, also bipolar. I've seen a lot of clients, because of the severe mood swings of the mania and the depression, that they will self-medicate, you know, with cocaine when they're very depressed and to take some sort of downer when they're having mania so they can sleep so they're not up for 3 days. And that becomes a very dangerous concoction that you're putting together. Have you ever overdosed on any drugs? Do you continue to use despite negative consequences? Do you think that you have a drug problem? What they said here, am I an addict? This is a question only you can answer. We found that we all answered different numbers of these questions, yes. The actual number of yes responses wasn't as important as how we felt inside and how addiction had affected our lives. Now, this is what Narcotics Anonymous is saying, and I think that was really interesting when they said, not really the answer yes, but what sort of inner response came? How did you feel about that? Because I think if we trust our gut instinct or what our first instinct feeling is, that we know that there's something wrong. And I think you can tell sometimes, is it fun or has this actually taken over your lives? And I said, some of these questions don't even mention drugs. This is because addiction is an insidious disease that affects all areas of our lives, even those areas which seem at first to have little to do with drugs. The different drugs we used were not as important as why we used them and what they did to us. I think that's also, you know, another thing. I don't know if you had any experience with this. The reasons why sometimes people start using because they're bored, because they're lonely, because they can't sleep, because they're angry, and then they use the alcohol or the drugs as a coping skill or as a way to go out and socialize. Have you had any experience with that?
Oh, yes. I have plenty of experience. You know, it's such a big topic, addictions. There's so many different kinds of addictions, and, you know, it can go anywhere from drugs, alcohol, smoking, drinking, coffee, and even work addiction. And an addiction is really something that you cannot stop. That's when you know you have an addiction. So, if you know, I'm glad the person that wrote the question is having fun, but I guess it's an alcohol question. I hate to assume anything, but if you can stop for a while and, you know, go out once a week or whatever, it's the extent of the addiction and how often you do it. Is it affecting your work, your social life, your family life? It's from one end to the other. How extreme is it? And there's also things called soft addictions, which is too much television. Some people are addicted to that. Too much of the food that you really like, that you're addicted to. So there's such a broad range of addictions, and there's a lot of research that's been done about it, and I'll talk about that, you know, in a few minutes.
Sure. And it's interesting that you said that, you know, that there's so many, there's hard addictions and there's soft addictions. And I found that when someone has an addictive personality, it does seem to carry over. It might just start, you know, with something small, but the addictive pattern kind of goes into all areas of their life, and I think it's something really to become aware of. And I know there's some things healthier than others to become addicted to, but I think also trying to figure out where is this addiction coming from? You know, what was the first trigger, if you can remember? And I think I've also read many times, and when I was in school, the age when the person really starts becoming an addict and really heavily using usually is the age they stop developing emotionally, mentally. So if you have someone who really started drinking heavily at age 21 and it really started not just going out with your friends drinking, but really heavily binge drinking all the time, even though you could be 40 now, if you've been drinking all those years or using drugs all those years, your emotional developmental stage is still at 21 because you haven't been sober all these years to grow up or to kind of emotionally progress. And have you seen that all? Because I know sometimes when there's comorbid, when there's also a mental illness and addiction, and I know you've worked a lot with mental illness, have you seen anything with that where there's been, especially when you're on psychiatric medication?
Well, you're really not supposed to drink or do drugs when you're on psychiatric medication. It only makes things worse. I've seen people do it, and I think they realize down the road that it's not good to do. And what happens, a lot of times what happened in the individuals I was working with, they really grouped together to go out because they kind of all knew they couldn't drink. So they would actually go to bars or restaurants and all order soda. So I think being connected, having a group that others don't drink, you know, is a lot easier to go out with than people that do drink. So that's always worked with individuals that I worked with.
Mm-hmm. I think there's also a danger with medication that maybe one time you went out and drank on medication or used drugs and you know, thank God you survived, but there's always that chance next time you do that will be your last time. And I'm sorry that I'm sounding so serious about it, but I've definitely seen a lot of people where, you know, they've gotten really, really sick, and there's also been times when it's actually resulted in death. And I think it's also making sure you're really aware of what's going on, and I think if you're taking that risky behavior, to also be aware about that. And what they also go on to say here is, when we first read these questions, it was frightening for us to think we might be addicts. Some of us try to dismiss these thoughts by saying, oh, those questions don't make sense, or I'm different. I know I take drugs, but I'm not an addict. I have real emotional family job problems. I'm just having a tough time, and I'm getting it together right now. So again, I think what we were saying before, using it to self-medicate, using, you know, kind of making an excuse or saying, you know, this is only going to be temporary, but you might have the best intention for this to only be temporary, but addiction has a mind of its own. When it takes its over and it takes its course, it takes its course. And, you know, I think there are some people that, I don't know how they do it, but can overcome this on their own. But from a professional background, I really feel that you need a whole team behind you. And it's not because you're not strong enough, but I think it's such a tough disease and it's such a stronghold that you really need, you know, you need support. And there's also a lot of medical conditions, too. Another comment they had is, I'll be able to stop when I find the right person or get the right job. And I think that's, again, you know, almost back to what I was saying couple shows back on the five stages of grief where we use bargaining. And I think that's something that comes up, like, if I do this, then this will happen, or if maybe this happens, then I can do this. But I think if you find yourself bargaining, it also brings up other ideas, say, okay, what's going on in my life? Because I think when you do find the right person, is that really going to stop you from using? And I know you had some studies about genetics and about alcoholism, about what is actually going on, and it's pretty serious with what you were saying about them. I don't know if you wanted to go over with them, go through them now.
Well, there's always great websites to go into, but one that I found very interesting was addictionsandrecovery.org. And there's this CAGE test for alcohol addiction, and it's just four simple questions which really puts it in perspective if you're addicted. And this is actually relating to alcohol, which I think the question is about. The first one, have you ever felt you should cut down on your drinking? Have you ever been annoyed when people have commented on your drinking? 3, have you ever felt guilty or badly about your drinking? Or 4, have you ever had an eye-opener first thing in the morning to steady your nerves or get rid of a hangover? So those are kind of just simple, basic questions that, you know, if those come to your mind, there's something going on, and it's a good thing you're realizing it, and hopefully you can get the help, get the support. I think in that level, you can kind of help yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's, you know, people that drink early in the morning, drink all day, you know, that really need the help. But if you're asking yourself those questions in the morning, it's time to look and see what you can do about it and just maybe, I don't know, cut down or whatever, because other studies show that if you have, there's a modified CAGE test for all addictions, which is 4 simple questions, which says, have you ever thought you should cut down on your use of drugs? Pretty much the same questions, have you ever been annoyed when people have commented on your use? Have you ever felt guilty or badly about your use? Have you ever used drugs to ease withdrawal symptoms? So everything is really in that kind of place between alcohol, drugs, those
food addiction.
Any kind of addiction, like we said. And addiction is like a disease. It is a disease. It's been confirmed that it's a disease. So, you know, and they go into an order test for alcohol addiction, and they mentioned that one can of beer, one glass of wine, one shot of liquor, the 3 different types of the drinking, and they say, how often do you have a drink containing alcohol? And then monthly or less, 2 to 4 times a month, 2 to 3 times a week, 4 more times a week. So they get, and it continues, but you can go on their website, and I think it was very interesting to see how the questions and how often you do it, because some people think that to have, you know, a couple of beers a week is awful, you know, where other people don't think
it's okay.
So
yeah.
These questions go on, and like I said, it's addictionsandrecovery.org. And also, you know, as Alexa mentioned, you know, it's also hereditary kind of, genetics. They say the children of addicts are 8 times more likely to develop an addiction. So the family history is very important to check that. I think people are more open these days, you know, than way back when they kind of kept it in the closet. But, you know, when there's children involved, you want to set their, you know, path clear, because it can happen to them, and so that you'll be able, and this, again, is mentioned, that the genetics of addiction is mentioned in this website.
So also, I also noticed here on Narcotics Anonymous, they said we face 3 disturbing realizations. Number 1, we are powerless over addiction, and our lives are unmanageable. 2, although we are not responsible for our disease, we are responsible for our recovery. Now, that's a really, really powerful statement. I've never heard of it actually put in that way, but I think it's also, it's a thing. I know sometimes when we have a disease, like if we're not, you know, we're not responsible sometimes when we get a medical condition, but I think we are responsible on how we react to it. Again, if we talk about anger, anxiety, it's about how we react to it. I think when we start realizing that we have this disease, you know, having the awareness to take the steps towards recovery, and again, as I said, building the support system. And the 3rd one, we can no longer blame people, places, and things for our addictions. We must face our problems and our feelings. The ultimate weapon for recovery is the recovering addict. I mean, that's another thing I find is really interesting and incredible about Narcotics Anonymous, Alcoholics Anonymous. I've had a lot of clients that have been involved in both. And it's such a strong community. And as what you were saying before, with people that have been on medication, they do groups and they go out together. You know, I find that having this sort of this support team, if they have different functions, they have meetings every day, every night, so you can always surround yourself with people for that support. So I know we've gotten pretty serious with this question. They said, how do I know if I'm addicted to something or having too much fun? I think the fun sort of stops here, when you really start taking a look at these questions and at these statements that have been made. And I think really taking a personal inventory and saying, okay, where do I fit on these different scales? And this might just be a little bit of a wake-up call. This might be awareness. Maybe, you know, you're not addicted yet or in that position. But I think sometimes we have a choice in life if we're going to head down towards that path. And you might be at this crossroads where you're really kind of close of taking that step, or, you know, maybe being around certain people that this is something that's common, it's all the time, or, you know, this is something you find yourself medicating or something's going on, because I also find a lot of times when there's personal trauma, domestic violence, sexual abuse, sometimes to kind of numb themselves, alcohol and drugs are used. So again, I think definitely if you're really having questions, seek a therapist, go to your regular doctor, and really just speak to them and really be open about it. It's nothing to be ashamed about. It's nothing to feel guilty about. You know, this is a disease, and I think it's always prevention, pre-prevention, taking preventive measures is the best we can do for ourselves. So I hope we answered all your questions. Please keep us, you know, posted. If you have any more questions or feedback, you can always send questions or feedback to insightintohealing@gmail.com. Or you can go Insight into Healing on Facebook and private message me or send me a question right on the page. Let's go to our next question. Dear Insight into Healing, what is the difference between schizoaffective disorder and schizophrenia? Well, this is a tough one, too. I always get sort of, I have, you know, as a therapist, people say, how do you remember all these criteria? How do you remember, you know, all this, all the medications? And I'll be honest, I don't. I use the DSM-4. I mean, there's a DSM-5 now, but I haven't gotten to that one yet. But I have the DSM-4. And what I like to do, especially, you know, when clients are coming, are complaining with different symptoms or different criteria, and I find, like, a lot now because of the Internet, there's a lot of this criteria stuff you can look right up. People are self-diagnosing. So we want to make sure, because sometimes we can hear some of this and say, ooh, and kind of go run with it. It's really important that you kind of go to a professional, but if some of these red flags are coming up, again, seek professional help. What they're saying with schizophrenia, before becoming ill, the patient may have a withdrawn or otherwise peculiar personality. The illness begins gradually. At least 6 months before the diagnosis is made, behavior begins to change. Now, this I'm getting from the DSM-4 Made Easy by Morrison. The next one. During at least 1 month of those 6 months, the patient has been frankly psychotic. There have been two or more of the five basic symptom types described earlier. Those would be involved delusions or hallucinations, may begin with milder symptoms such as beliefs that are peculiar but not psychotic. The illness causes important problems with work and social functioning, obviously, and the clinician can exclude mood disorders, substance abuse, and general medical factors as probable causes. Although most patients improve with treatment, relatively few recover to such an extent that they are completely back to normal. And I find, I think, also medication is a really serious component to help treat schizophrenia. There are several reasons why it's important to diagnose schizophrenia accurately. One is frequency. Approximately 1% of the general adult population will contract this disorder. It is a common disease. Chronicity. Most patients who develop schizophrenia continue to have symptoms throughout their lives. Severity. Although most patients do not require months or years of hospitalization, as it used to be the case, incapacity for social and work functioning can be found. See, I see this often. I treat a lot of clients with schizophrenia. I know there's such a stigma with schizophrenia that you have to be, you know, hospitalized all the time, that you can't be out in the world functioning. And I work with a lot of clients that have schizophrenia, and you really wouldn't actually know it right away. It takes time, and I think they can hold down jobs. They can have a life if they stay on their medication, and they also, again, get their support team, have a therapist, have a psychiatrist, sometimes they have day programs to kind of make sure reality, there's always some reality testing. Management. Adequate treatment almost always means using neuroleptic medications, which carry a risk of tardive dyskinesia and often must be taken on a lifelong basis. Now, I know that's a hard thing for a lot of people to hear, is having to be on medication for the rest of their life. But I have found that mostly with schizophrenia, usually medication is something that's really, really part of, like, the treatment. What do you think, Maureen?
Well, this, you know, even sometimes I get confused and the different different symptoms, but pretty much the schizophrenia, okay, the symptoms are delusions, strange beliefs that are not based in reality, and that the person refuses to give up, even when presented with factual information. So that's a good example of somebody with schizophrenia.
Yeah.
Also hallucinations, which Alexa spoke about, and that includes hearing voices. disorganized thinking, odd or unusual behavior, slow movements or total immobility,
mm-hmm.
and then there's lack of emotion, which is a big sign of a schizophrenia, and then poor motivation and problems with speech and communication. And schizophrenia is really a brain disorder that distorts the way a person thinks and acts. It expresses emotions, perceives reality, and relates to others. Depression is an illness that is marked by feelings of sadness, worthlessness, or hopelessness, as well as problems concentrating and remembering detail. Bipolar disorder is characterized by cyclic mood changes, including severe high and lows. So that's pretty much the schizophrenia, you
yeah.
know, that we're talking about, and then I guess we'll get into the schizoaffective disorder. So I think we pretty much...
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting how we both said, I was just looking at the DSM-4 while you were speaking, and about how we were saying we sometimes have some confusion and it's hard to grasp. In the DSM-4, it states itself, schizoaffective disorder is just plain confusing. Over the years, it has meant many things to many clinicians. Because there were so many interpretations in use for this confusing category, the DSM-3 included no criteria for it all in 1980. But DSM-3R first attempted to specify the criteria in 1987. Most interpretations suggest that schizoaffective disorder, which is different than schizophrenia, is some sort of cross between a mood disorder and schizophrenia. Some writers regard it as a form of bipolar disorder because some patients seem to respond well to lithium. Other commentators believe it is closer to schizophrenia. Still others hold that it is an entirely separate type of psychosis or simply a collection of confusing, sometimes contradictory symptoms. I mean, this sounds all, I mean, can you imagine if it's confusing to the clinician, how confusing it must be for the clients who are suffering from schizophrenia, schizoaffective disorder, and also from the family members. So I think, again, this reinforces really, I think, making sure you get a couple of opinions, not just one, get a second and third opinion, and really keeping an eye on it. They said the A criteria for schizophrenia for at least a month, delusions or hallucinations without major mood symptoms for 2 weeks or more. Mood symptoms that meet criteria for major depressive, manic, or mixed episode, substantial period of total illness. Also, the criteria for schizoaffective disorder. During a continuous period of illness, for a substantial part of at least 1 month or less if effectively treated, the patient has had two or more of the following symptoms. As Maureen said, delusions. Only one symptom is required if a delusion is bizarre, such as being abducted in a spaceship from the sun. Hallucinations. Only one symptom is required if hallucinations are at least two voices talking to each other, or of a voice that keeps a running commentary on the patient's thoughts and actions. See, I find a lot of clients that I work with have these type of beliefs. They feel that their neighbors are speaking to them. Some actually feel that God has been spoken to them, and they have come down here as a messiah or as a prophet to speak God's word. So I think also to keep an eye of that, they also have a lot of different things of aliens, of people talking to them through objects, through the radio, through the television. Next is speech that shows incoherence, derailment, or other disorganization, severely disorganized or catatonic behavior. Any negative symptoms such as flat affect, reduced speech, or lack of volition. During the same continuous period of illness, the patient has had a major depressive episode that includes depressed moods or a manic episode or a mixed episode. For at least 2 weeks of this period, there have been delusions or hallucinations and no prominent mood symptoms. The mood episode symptoms have been present during a substantial part of the active and residual portions of the illness. This disorder is not caused directly by a general medical condition or the use of substances, including prescription medications. And that's another thing, as you know, from our question that we were just speaking about addiction. I think it's really serious that making sure, you know, sometimes with schizophrenia, substance abuse, finding out, again, the underlying factor. I mean, if you're using or if you're in withdrawal, as I know sometimes with alcohol, you have DTs and you have delusions and hallucinations. So to make sure, when are you having these delusions and hallucinations? Are you under the influence? Are these something that happen occurring all the time, or is it something that only happens when you're using? So again, this also takes down a different layer of what's going on. Maureen, what would you like to say about this?
Well, with the schizophrenia, you know, the hallucinations is very serious, and the delusions, hearing voices. A lot of times we recommend it to the individuals that we work with to get a Walkman, you know, when they're hearing these things. Put on the Walkman with some music or whatever. It's very difficult because they can be anywhere. They could be at home. They could be out in public. They could be at their recovery center, you know, and just get these hallucinations and hear these, you know, voices in their head. And it's very serious. But that was one thing, you know, with the Walkman, you know, and for people that have the mental illness and sometimes they don't have money to buy it, there's money in your case management. You know, you could talk to your case management, you know, and mm-hmm. have them get it and get some CDs and wear that. You'll see sometimes people walking with the Walkman, you know, around town or whatever. Sometimes, you know, I say to myself when I see them, maybe they have a mental illness, you know, and but it's just part of, you know, their recovery of how to handle it. It's very serious. It's very hard to deal with that and cope with that. But medication is good. It's not as severe as it used to be, but it's there still.
And you brought up something very interesting. A thought came to me about, you know, when you hear ideas of persecution. Are these voices, I think this is where it becomes dangerous, and this is also when I have clients who, you know, have delusions, hallucinations, auditory, visual. What are the voices telling you? Are the voices telling you to hurt yourself? Are your voices telling you to hurt somebody else? I think that's when it becomes very dangerous. And if you yourself are suffering from this, or your family member or someone you know, it's really, again, taking safety assessment. And it's almost like the suicide risk assessment. You know, is this ideation? Are you planning on hurting yourself? What are the voices telling you? Do you have a plan? Has there been past attempts? And I think if this really, you know, it sounds like this person is really believing that this voice is telling them to hurt themselves or to hurt other people, it's definitely the time, again, as safety first, to call 911 or take them immediately to the emergency room. Because those are, you know, it's very scary for the person that is experiencing these thoughts and hearing these things or seeing these visual things, but I think it's also for the community and for everyone, it's better to be safe than sorry. I know you said the Walkman helped a lot. Do you recommend anything else, you think, when someone is feeling this frightened or this overwhelmed?
Well, from the population I worked with, you know, it's not a study or a survey or anything. Most of the hallucinations are the same from the individuals I worked with. So, you know, we spoke about this in another show, a journal, writing down things, because with those hallucinations, you need to tell your psychiatrist, you need to tell the people that are involved in your recovery of what you're thinking, and they will be able to guide you and help you. Maybe you need an adjustment with your medications. But we spoke about that journal, how important it is, because when you go see your psychiatrist maybe 2 weeks later, you might forget that. But it's important for them to know what you're thinking, what voices you're hearing, and hopefully they can help you with things.
Mm-hmm.
But we would talk in the journal, everything, and the hallucinations, then it's a domino effect. Then your sleeping is not well. It's just, your body isn't healthy to handle all the things involved with everyday life.
And I think the journal also provides as a tool for reality testing. As I said before, with anxiety that we discussed, by having the journal about journaling, what was happening before the anxiety, during the anxiety attack, afterwards, I think what's happening before the delusions or hallucinations, what's happening afterwards, is that it's kind of, you're able, and you don't have to write down full sentences or anything like that. I think it's jotting down ideas, so then when you are in a calmer state, that you're able to kind of look back and say, what was this, and also doing reality checking, because I've worked with a lot of clients that have these hallucinations, these auditory hallucinations, delusions, on a pretty regular basis. And they are able to walk and function and still hear these voices and see these things, but they're able to tell themselves, I know that's not real, because they have the proof that they put it down in their journal, and they really, you know, between with therapy and medication, have kind of been able to gain confidence over. And yes, it'll be something that'll always be kind of underlying, but it's something that they can manage. I think that's also becomes the real question, is being able to manage it. Okay, so let's go on to our next question. Dear Insight into Healing, as I am finishing my master's in social work, how do I choose what population to work with? This is a great question. I think there's not a right answer. There's not a wrong answer. What I found when I went to social work school is some of the things you can either choose to be clinical, administrative, or research. I obviously chose clinical. So I think, number one, that's your first step. Are you going to be working, you know, clinical, research, or administrative? And also the setting. Do you want to work in a clinic? Do you want to work in a hospital? Do you want to work in a school? Do you want to work with people? Do you want to work directly with the clients? Or do you want to, you know, not be a direct care worker, but also work with maybe the staff, and I think, or supervision? It becomes so, you know, so in different layers. I think by the way of really figuring out what population you want to work with is being able to have some experience. And I think also when you're finishing your master's, usually what they do is you have different internships or field placements. And I think that really gives you a good idea of the field placements that you were in, the populations that you were working with, what you really enjoyed. My first population I worked with was domestic violence. And it was something I knew, this is a population I really want to work with. It's actually become one of my specialties, is domestic violence. And the second one is I worked in a large hospital in the mental health clinic, and that was something I said, you know what, that's definitely what I want to do. And so I've worked, you know, my specialties were, you know, mental health and domestic violence, and I find those two are really something that, you know, I feel comfortable with. I think it also starts raising the question, some populations, due to personal reasons, due to just any reasons, just due to your own personality or anything, it might not be a good fit for you. They always say if you're going through a personal problem in that area, or if you have a family member with that, that might not be right away the first population to work with. Sometimes people, if they have issues with death and dying, working with elderly is really hard to work with, or sometimes working with children might not be. And it doesn't mean you're a bad social worker, that you should be able to do that. Just because you're a social worker doesn't mean that you should work, that you have to work with every population and be the best. You know, we're human. You have to pick and choose where your strengths are, and I think that's the best advice that I could give. Maureen, what do you think?
Well, the social work field is always on the rise. I read one article that said in the year 2000, we had over 500,000 social workers in the United States. That's a lot, and
wow.
That was back in 2000. And it's on the rise. There's a lot of people with problems, with issues that need to be addressed. But it's such a broad field. I mean, I was reading different things. They're in schools. They're in police departments. They're you work with individuals, families, communities. They're in private businesses, schools, nursing homes, private practice. They're in the court system. The social workers are all over, and I don't think people realize everywhere they are.
No.
And I never thought in business, you know, businesses, they do have social workers.
Yes.
And I just thought that was pretty amazing. There's, and then different kinds of who to deal with, different topics of social work. I mean, you have substance misuse and addictions. You have aging, child welfare, public welfare, school social work, justice, corrections, developmental disabilities, employment, occupational social work, health care. I mean, it's just such a broad. So I think you need to narrow it down first by maybe the population that you'd like to serve. Maybe Alexa's more familiar in this field because she is a social worker. I just was associated with my individuals I work with social workers. But, you know, go with who you really think you can help the most. But basically, a social worker is somebody that cares about people. So I think whoever you decide to work with, just that you have that caring in you, you'll be able to work with children, adolescents, adults. And you want to make things better for people. You want to relieve suffering, and you want your work to make a difference.
Yes. I think what Maureen was saying, you know, even with businesses, there is human resources. Any huge company, that you hit the major Fortune 500 companies, they have human resources, and they have social workers there. You know, they have people that do sexual harassment, you know, problems. One of our next questions is a place of employment when there's problems in the place of employment. They have, you know, workers there. And I think it's really just an amazing field, and people really don't realize, as you said, how huge it really is. I mean, you can work in a school, you can work in a hospital, and also between also administrative and research, you can also do research, you know, finding out about medications or finding out what different environmental, social, personal factors impact different types of races or communities or education. And I think it was so huge. I mean, when I was in school, social work school, I took a research class. I mean, it was tough stuff. Especially if you're really good in math, research will be really good for you. So that was a tough one. Research was tough for me. But it was just, I mean, amazing when you find the correlation between what's happening and what impacts the other and the different studies. I mean, that's someone, I mean, no one would ever think that that was part of social work. And you do all these different types of studies. I know, you know, different types of schools or different types of things come to agencies to do. I know there's one that's going on for suicide and mental illness. Then there's another one with mental illness and substance abuse, and really finding out, because I think the social work field is changing so much, and also between mental illness and substance abuse and medication, and I think because each person is so different, that each case is so different, that it's just the field is growing. The social work field is definitely growing, so I'm very, very excited about that. And I think as you're finishing, you also have a supervisor, and I think also, you know, throwing some options to her and really figuring out, you know, what do you feel your strengths are? What do you feel that you want to learn more? Because you never learn too much in this field. You know, and I think that's one thing as a social worker, as a therapist, I think Maureen feels the same way. You can't be embarrassed to say, you know what, I'm not familiar with that. Let me go check out on that. And I think that's what I do. A lot of times I read stuff and I research before the show because this all just doesn't come from my head. It's years of reading and working with people. So I think give yourself time when choosing which population you want to work with. And there's no right answer. There's no wrong answer. It's just learning and moving forward. So want to go on to our next question?
Well, there's also a great website, National Association of Social Workers, NASW.com, which will give you more information on different choices and the careers in social work. So you can look into that.
Great.
Good luck.
Thank you. Let's go on to our fourth and last question because we're running out of time so quickly tonight. At my place of employment, there is a coworker of mine that talks on her cell phone all the time and is very loud. It is driving me crazy. What do I do? I'm nervous if I complain to my boss that she will retaliate. Well, I think that's also a very serious problem. I think also what we were just talking about before about working, having social workers in our human resource department. This might be something that you want to go to the human resource department, and you can remain anonymous and discuss with them, you know, what you're feeling. You know, if this is really impacting your work and your productivity, this might be something. I know sometimes it's hard to approach, and it sounds like, you know, she's very loud, and what do I do? And I don't know if she really, obviously she's not listening to what you're saying. I don't know if you really approached her or not, but that can also cause some conflict. So I think maybe talking first to your supervisor or also going to human resources, and, you know, I think there's usually a procedure of making a complaint. What do you think, Maureen?
Obviously, I don't know the size of the office, but most organizations, companies have a human resources department. They should have, and that within that human resources comes a corporate compliance that actually people have to take once a year, and one of these issues is about cell phone usage and common courtesy to other, you know, staff members there. So You can do that at the Human Resources, the Corporate Compliance. A Corporate Compliance usually has a hotline, which is an anonymous. You don't have to leave your name or anything, just the situation. I mean, you can have somebody else call so that they won't recognize your voice, because it is a tender situation, and
yes,
you have to work together. You have to work as a team. If those two things don't work, you could always mail an anonymous letter that's just typed on a computer, no return address to the president of the company or whatever, if you want to go further up the line, if Human Resources hasn't, you know, helped you with that. But there's no reason why they should be talking that much on the cell phone.
No.
They're not.
It's probably affecting their work.
Yeah.
And I know for a lot of large agencies, they have a procedure about not having retaliation on, as they call it, the whistleblower. And there's a whole procedure that there will not be retaliation if you complain about someone. And if that does happen, they also have another, you know, organization or another team that you can go to if you feel like that you made a complaint and now there's been, you know, retaliation by the coworker you complained about or by, you know, your supervisor, anybody in your agency. So I think now it's become so, you know, so serious, and, you know, agencies are really becoming more aware of what happens in the office, and it's not just, oh, we have to get along and deal with it. It's really serious what's going on with in the office. I think someone talking on their cell phone is definitely a no-no. I know it's not supposed to be any personal use of cell phone or even personal use of your computer when you're on the computer doing anything personal. So I know that sounds like a definitely direct violation of any agency laws or procedures. So I would definitely agree, go to Corporate Compliance. You also might want to get your agency, your company's handbook, employee handbook, and they usually should have a procedure for you to follow in case you have a complaint. I think that's definitely the best thing, because it sounds like this coworker, I bet you're not the only person that this coworker is annoying, yes, and is causing problems. I know it's hard. You don't want to be the first one to say something, but I think for your own productivity and your own peace of mind, that definitely I would step forward and check it out and let us know. And please, you know, keep us posted and let us know what happens with that. We're almost at the end of our show. Maureen, did you have any more on this question?
On the question, there's also a website, DaleCarnegie, .com, D-A-L-E, Carnegie, C-A-R-N-E-G-I-E.com, that talks about conflict resolutions in the office place. And you can go on that website and go in and read, and it's very interesting what they talk about. In your situation with the cell phone, some companies actually arrange for a time where people could go outside and talk on the cell phone. So there's all different ways, you know, that the retaliation doesn't happen, that that person who's talking on the cell phone will have time to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And so that it's not total withdrawal for that person. So, like I said, DaleCarnegie.com, I found it very interesting, the website.
Oh, wow. Okay, great. So definitely I will also begin to post a lot of the stuff that we spoke about on the show today. I also posted Maureen's fabulous time management and study procedure that she put up with all the different hours of sleep and study and school. Everybody loved that. So I definitely, you can find that. That was posted last week on the website. As you know, what I like to do at the end of each show is give a journaling exercise. I find that journaling is really an important tool to use for helping, you know, promoting your healing and your personal growth and also awareness about what's going on. This actual exercise I was told about by my friend Tom. It's actually called three letters. What it is, it's three letters that you're going to write. With these letters, you do not have to mail them to the person. You don't have to show it to the person. This is really for your own personal use, your own personal growth. Letter number one, write a letter to the person who has hurt you or upset you. In this letter, you will be explaining about what's going on, how you're feeling. And feel free if you feel like cursing or you feel like getting angry. You're allowed to do that. This does not have to be a polite letter. No one is really going to see this letter except you. So I think really being it, be truthful. And don't be afraid to hurt this person's feelings. This person's probably not going to see this letter. So keep this letter. Really make sure you're not holding back. Let them know how you're feeling. Of course, always stay in a safe place. If you feel like your emotions are getting too high, you might want to take a step back. Letter number two, write a letter to your inner child, acknowledging the past pain and the promise of the healing. I know this might sound a little strange, But as you know, as you write a child, if I were to write a letter, it would be to Alexa, who was 6 years old or 7 years old, whatever age you feel. It's kind of just saying, you know, I understand what happened. You must be really scared. Almost what you would say if a child came to you, your own child or a child you work with or a child on the street and was telling you how frightened or upset they were. Writing that child to, letter to that child, explain to them that it's okay and kind of giving them comfort and safety. The last letter is writing a letter to God, thanking him for his grace. I found this very powerful because it's almost a release of what's going on. And I think, as we said before in a couple of the other shows, gratitude. And I know I've mentioned this before, you know, what are five things that you're grateful for? And I think always, you know, writing something, thanking, showing, you know, that you're grateful. And I think also putting a positive end to this, because I find with writing sometimes the first letter can really stir up a lot of different emotions. And we want to always make sure we keep you in a safe environment so you can able to kind of reel yourself back in. So the first letter, you know, you'll find yourself, you know, probably being upset. The second letter, kind of teaching yourself self-soothing, teaching yourself being able to pamper yourself, to also use self-affirmation. And also that's also building your confidence that if something comes up later on, you can use these tools to self-soothe or to kind of also get your own closure. Sometimes we have people in our life who we can't get closure from or we won't get what we need. This is also being able to fill that void and getting that closure for yourself. And the last letter, I think, is really powerful, the letter to God, because it's a healing. It's of letting go to a higher power, saying to ourselves that this is no longer in our hands. And yes, it still might be upsetting for us that we are letting go and we're lifting it up to God. And I think it's also very empowering to be able to say, you know what, I'm done with this. And I guess being able to kind of put it to rest and I guess finding the peace within the chaos with this and really being able to start your healing process and your growth. What do you think, Maureen?
Definitely. I think that I like the second one. Relating as a child, how you see things as a small, you know, a younger individual. I think they're great.
Thank you. I think really, you know, a lot of people don't realize I use this a lot in my practice with talking to, going back and talking to your inner child, and people are like, what does that mean? You know, they laugh at me, and I say, I know.
I think it's a great idea.
It really is. I mean, it's really, you know, we need to self-nurture, and we really need to talk to that child. Yes, we're older, and people say, we should be over it, get over it. You know what? No, we need to go back, and we need to give what maybe we didn't get as a child, we need to give it to ourselves. That's the most powerful thing, and that's how we start with the healing and the growth. Well, I'd love to thank everyone so much for listening tonight. Again, any questions, comments, feedback, please send your questions or emails to insightintohealing@gmail.com, or you can go to Facebook and look up Insight Into Healing, and please give us a like. If you could also check out Penelope's film fan page and Cervellino Productions. Well, everyone, I just want to say thank you so much for listening, and I will be taking us out with a song that we heard in the beginning. It is Every Good Thing by The Actors. So everyone, good night, and God bless.